Gentlemen, our first case for argument this morning is United States v. Ochoa Zarate. Mr. Masioli.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Mark Michalik for Mr. Ochoa Zarate. Benjamin must be retried because the government's improper rebuttal argument denied Benjamin a right to fair trial by impermissibly drawing the jury's attention to his right to remain silent. The District Court also abused its discretion by allowing expert testimony disguised as lay opinion, which the government wanted to use as proof that Benjamin knew there were drugs in the vehicle he was driving. When the state trooper stopped Benjamin on the Illinois highway, Benjamin cooperated with the trooper. The trooper asked for consent to search the vehicle, and Benjamin allowed that. The trooper found several kilograms of methamphetamine secreted in the spare tire of the van. After that, Benjamin suffered what appeared to be a panic attack and subsequently was in jail. At trial, Roger Bailey, who started out as a co-defendant, testified against Benjamin. Roger Bailey had a plea agreement in place. Because of that, the defense argued that he had a motive to fabricate in his testimony. The government argued in response to the defense that because Mr. Bailey had testified and had pled guilty, that he was accepting responsibility. Now, it was proper for the government to do that to bolster the credibility of a witness once the defense had attacked that credibility. But then the government went a step further and directly compared Mr. Bailey to Benjamin, saying that, well, Mr. Bailey has accepted responsibility. As of today, Benjamin has not. And now the government argues in its brief that the prosecutor is only referring to statements, the admissions that came in during trial by Benjamin that are arguably not true, that are arguably lies. However, the defense believes that what the government was really doing was, you know, because when you're saying taking responsibility as of today, that the only way that somebody could possibly take responsibility at a trial is to get up and testify.
Well, there are two possible interpretations of the prosecutor's statement. One is that it was a complaint about what happened in court, and the other is that it dealt with what happened before they got to court. And one of them is appropriate and the other is not. Was there any request to the prosecutor to disambiguate the statement?
Your Honor, the statement came during rebuttal, and the defense did object. The court immediately overruled the objection.
What was the objection? Was it, this is an ambiguous statement, or is it, this statement cannot be made?
Your Honor, the record reflects that the defense objected. The court immediately overruled the objection, and
The rules provide that when a lawyer objects, he has to state a reason. What was the reason stated?
There was argument after.
Was there a request for a reason stated from the court, or was it just a plain objection, a motion to withdraw a juror? I can go back and look at the record, but I assume you'll have looked at it more carefully than I have.
Your Honor, my recollection of the record is that the defense argued after rebuttal argument was over. There was no argument.
He didn't argue during the argument itself.
No, Your Honor.
He just moved to withdraw the juror.
No, he objected. The judge overruled it and asked the defense asked to be heard at a later time.
Oh. So there was just objection, period. Not objection, misstatement. Not objection, error. This implicates this Fifth Amendment right. It was just objection. The court said overruled, and then later it was discussed.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're trying to clarify.
Yes, Your Honor.
I take it you did not try the case.
No, Your Honor, I did not.
Well, I suspect what the court was jumping in fast so that it wouldn't get any worse. But I'm not sure. I'd have to read the record.
Well, Your Honor, nevertheless, I believe that the jury would naturally take the most natural interpretation for the jury to draw from the government's statement was that, to wonder why Benjamin had not testified.
Had not testified or why he hadn't pled. But even if we give you that, if we say it was error and the district court improperly overruled the objection, then we get to the harmless error analysis. And we have a situation here where the defendant made a number of statements that were lies that were presented to the jury, should the jury have found Bailey credible. And so isn't there enough evidence anyway to sustain it? I mean, what's the impact of the error?
Your Honor, I believe, you know, I concede that the evidence is sufficient. I believe the jury could draw the inference from the fact that methamphetamine was in the van.
Right.
That he knew that it was there. But I don't think that is an inevitable. I don't think that is an inevitable inference. And I think that in a case where the defendant elects not to testify and that can't be held against him, that it's particularly damaging for that fact to be brought up against it or brought to the jury's attention.
But like you said, it's particularly damaging that the drugs were found in the car.
Clearly, Your Honor.
And then when he's asked about, you know, why he has the car, where he's going with the car, how long he's got the car for, you know, he says that he was visiting his sister in Chicago, and the cousin testified the sister lived in Sacramento, and Bailey suggested that he fly to New York, which contradicted the other testimony. So I'm just saying, you know, if you're conceding that there was sufficient evidence absent this statement, then, I mean...
Well, I just don't believe that the error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I believe that, I mean, if you think of the case where there is a drug mule who doesn't know that there are drugs in the car, what is he going to do? What evidence is he going to present to show that's the case, except his own testimony, which he has the right not to do? So here, the government, by relying on an improper argument, you know, it's not like Benjamin had drugs on him or that there were other evidence of drug dealing, cut corners, scales, or anything like that. There are some inconsistent statements and things that are arguably not true, but beyond that, there's no smoking gun. Your Honors, at trial, the government also asked the trooper if it was common in his training and experience that people who consented to searches would later admit that there were drugs in the vehicle or that they knew that the drugs were in the vehicle. The defense again lodged an objection, and there was a lengthy discussion off the record or on the record.
Lodged an objection on what ground? I think the proper objection to this is irrelevance. Was there ever a relevance objection raised?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that the defense's objection was that they had insufficient notice that the trooper was going to be testifying about consent searches, and also that the...
They just objected to the fact that he sounded like an expert and had not been qualified as an expert.
Your Honor, I believe he had been qualified as an expert to testify about drug dealing in general and about methamphetamine.
Not about whether people... Or it's not a field of expertise to say that in your experience, a number of people have given consent when they knew there was stuff in the car.
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's expert testimony because the...
I don't doubt that, but I said that I'm talking about the predicate for the objection.
Suggested
they hadn't noticed, they didn't get notice of the fact that he was going to testify to it?
In addition to that, Your Honor, the defense objected because he thought that the question went to the defendant's mental state. And the judge... in an attempt to craft a compromise.
I don't comprehend that. The only thing to which this testimony might be relevant would be a motion to suppress. But juries don't decide motions to suppress. Only the judge does that.
Well, Your Honor...
I take it from your initial answer that there was no relevance objection.
I don't believe there was. The other objection...
It seems weird to spend time during trial to discuss an issue that is pertinent only to a motion to suppress that's not before the jury.
You're into your rebuttal time, my friend.
Then I will sit down. Thank you, Your Honors.
Clever.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Hartzler.
Good morning. Joe Hartzler on behalf of the United States.
Morning.
To address first the question of the trooper's testimony, he was not permitted to testify about the knowledge of a driver who consents to a search.
Testified about his experience. Is it uncommon for people who have been stopped to give consent, even though there is drugs in the car? And he answered, no, it's not
right.
Uncommon.
That's right. So I'm responding to your statement about whether or not this elicited any information about knowledge, and I thought defense counsel effectively prevented that information from coming in to trial, which Judge Easterbrook, I think, might have been considered relevant, but this thing got whittled down so that it became this innocuous, irrelevant testimony about...
The question was asked so that the jurors wouldn't think that because the guy had given consent that meant he didn't think there were drugs in the car.
Well, that may have been why it was asked, but that's not what the question was.
What was the question?
The question was, is it not uncommon for drugs to be found in consent searches of vehicles? I'm paraphrasing.
Well, that's the same thing. It's just saying, the only reason you'd ask that question is to eliminate the possibility a jury might think, gee, he didn't know there were drugs there, otherwise he wouldn't have given consent.
Well, the original question did ask whether or not defendants know there are drugs in the car
and that was objected to
and yet consent.
So the question was rephrased as, is it uncommon?
Is it uncommon? Which eliminated the whole issue of whether or not this defendant or any defendant knows that there are drugs in the car, in the vehicle.
No, it doesn't. It leaves the implication that even though people know there are drugs in the car, it is not uncommon for them to give consent, which it might indicate a couple of things. One of them is he's stupid. The other thing is that he doesn't think there are drugs in the car and somebody else put them there.
Well, the reason this question was permitted, I think, was that the judge viewed it as explaining the trooper's behavior. And we point out in our brief that...
Is that what the judge said? It was explaining the trooper's behavior?
Explaining the trooper's behavior. That the judge.
Is that what the judge said?
Yes. There was quite a considerable conference on this very issue. And the judge concluded that he thought it would be valuable to the jurors to understand why a trooper would go ahead and search a vehicle after the operator of the vehicle had consented to a search. Well, why would he be wasting his time? And, of course...
It seems to me that once you got consent, you might as well go ahead and search. Whether it makes sense or not, the question is whether it was reversible error. So it's not the point.
Right, and we smile about it because we all here know that it's common for drugs to be found after consent searches. In fact, I wanted to clarify the point in our brief where we say the judge practically could have taken judicial notice of this. I don't mean to suggest that the judge could have, should have, or would have.
I back away quietly from we all know because I have never searched a car vehicle in my life other than my own. So, and I never ask anybody for consent. So I'm relying only on my experience of reading brilliant cases.
Very well.
Okay.
Based on your experience, similar to the trooper's experience in training, you have reason to believe that drugs are found in vehicles where the operators have consented to searches. Based on my experience, I have the same.
Yes.
And so the point is that there's really little question about the accuracy of this information. In fact, I don't think the defendant is challenging the accuracy, challenging the qualifications of the trooper. And so the question comes down to whether or not this is could have in any way prejudiced this defendant. I think it did not. And therefore, the court, of course, did not abuse its discretion in permitting the question to proceed. Regarding the rebuttal argument, I think that the defendant would have a better argument if he had remained silent throughout. But Judge Williams, as you point out, and he repeatedly made statements that the government characterized as being false or lies. And when defense counsel stood up in his closing argument and challenged the credibility of the government's star witness, that set up the contrast, the conflict in this case. I mean, if there was any drama in this case, that was it. It was the statement of Roger Bailey versus the...
Of course, but could have solved the problem if he had started the question by saying, now, when he started his argument, say when they arrested him, he didn't admit anything. He denied everything. He lied. He didn't accept responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, there's no question about it.
That would have taken care of the problem.
Ambiguity of the question or the statement could have been avoided. It could easily have been avoided by remarking upon the fact that the comment was about the defendant's statements out in the street or after he was arrested to the task force agents.
Right. And then after the objection was made and it was overruled by the court, the prosecutor could have gone back and cleaned it up then.
I think he did. That's
what I mean.
I think he did clean it up. I think if you look at the rest of the closing, the rebuttal argument, I think he does come back and notes that the burden is on the government to prove.
Right. He says the burden is on the government, but specifically this particular statement he was referencing. When he was talking about taking responsibility, he didn't clarify then what he was talking about on the street.
I see.
I'm just saying that could have been clarified when the objection was made. That could have been clarified right on the moment.
Right.
We understand that's what your interpretation is, but you can certainly understand how the jury could draw the adverse inference from that. that is, that the prosecutor was commenting on his going to trial in this matter.
Going to trial, not his silence. Yes.
Right.
I can understand the ambiguity, yes.
And it was pretty strong language the prosecutor used, quote, and that's the difference between Roger Bailey and this defendant.
And the judge who heard it concluded that in the context of this trial and in the context of the closing argument, the jurors would not have likely interpreted it that way. Some other judge on some other day might have decided it differently, but I don't believe that that discretionary call was improper. The judge decided to exercise his discretion and not grant a mistrial based on his interpretation of how the jurors in this case, following the testimony and the closing arguments, would consider that statement.
And the jurors were instructed very carefully that the defendant didn't have to say anything and not to take anything at all on that.
Right.
So.
And I'm almost out of time, but the objection you ask about is in the transcript at page 397 to 398, and the objection is immediately after the statement by the prosecutor, Mr. Tassif objects and says, objection, I would like to be heard at sidebar at a later time, and then the court overrules that objection.
That was the only spot of the objection.
Correct. There are no further questions. Thank you very much.
Anything further, Mr. Masiovic?
Thank you, Your Honors. The district court ruled first that the trooper could not testify as an expert about consent searches, and then he allowed testimony based on specialized knowledge. That circumvented Rule 702. And the whole point of having that rule there is that in conjunction with Rule 16A1G, is that the defense gets notice and can contest the bases for the opinions and ultimately come to reliability, as the Daubert case commands. I'd like to point out briefly that the government relies on the Breck versus Abrahamson case for the proposition that there has to be a substantial injurious effect on the defense. But the whole Brecht versus Abrahamson case was the Supreme Court announcing a higher standard for collateral review than for direct review. There's no further questions. I have no more argument. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under